I'm John Schramm, and this is the third session in Religious Orders and the Renewal of the Church. And we've moved from a historic summary of what orders are to testing their validity as a form of renewal, partly because there was a lack of freedom and because they tend toward a possible legalism, because the freedom of the gospel allows in Protestantism movements, societies, fellowships, institutes that can accomplish what the orders wanted to accomplish without the kind of restrictions that are there by definition in the orders. In a healthy tension between those, accountability to the church, freedom from a dead institution, however that was phrased yesterday, we have our own way in which we could shape something that we thought was a faithful response to the gospel. So the assignment for today was to take a call for a new order, an order of St. Martin in response to violence in our society and in a lack of the church speaking clearly in a protest movement against that violence. And the attempt today will be to shape an order or to shape a community that might be part of such an order, to give our own attempt at a design. We admitted yesterday that it was probably easier to criticize what is than to shape something that is new. I don't know how you did in that assignment, and depending upon how much homework you did, what kind of lists you have, what kind of, whether they are very broad in the way of principles with which you will write vows or form a community, or whether they are very specific in, I would like a community that, and then have how decisions are made, whether it's geographical proximity to one another, whether it's common life together, meals together as an essence, depending upon what you do, we'll see what kind of shape we get. Somebody willing to start the sharing? I'm assuming that your reading of Metz, the reading that 10 of us did besides Metz, and the discussion of 2 days will all be brought into this morning in one way or another, but you don't have to say what you're reporting on today. You just be part of a general discussion.
I think one of the distinctions that I saw was perhaps the beginning of a community and an already ongoing community. I think there's some differences in needs and for the community that are for right now, in their beginning stages, need different kinds of things than when the building is done and when it's in operation. Perhaps there needs to be a differentiation between a group of people who get together in community to begin a ministry and those who continue or maintain it afterwards.
Let's stay on that one a little bit. How many of you in some way said, I want from the start to design flexibility so that we do not set something that will be outmoded 2 years later, but we are stuck with old forms, or 200 years later, and we are stuck with old forms? How many built in dynamic rather than static? Okay, quite a few of you. Do some of the rest of you want to say how you built that in, or whether any of you had a specific way in which you build that in from the start? To have it as an ideal is easier than to build it in. How would you do that, Mike?
The only way I could think of, I couldn't imagine a order just away from me. I have to think, well, what if I was a part of it?
Good. Yeah, that's what I hope. All right.
If there was an order there,
okay,
if I started there, what would it be about, and what would it do, in encompassing the proposal, and start listing what, including the marks that you put up on the board, right? Focus, rule, vows, focus, and to others, the vows portion and the rules portion, and to start off, they were just very. Like the vow of poverty would embrace the theology of enough is enough.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That would be fairly loose and just encourage simplistic living, a non-acquiring attitude, and for the vow of obedience would be obedience to the focus of the order, and the would be a self-chastisement type thing where nobody's going to stand over you and make sure you obey, but that if you're committed, that you chastise yourself. That's the only kind of flexibility as far as I got in rules, that would be a flexibility in that, that would be too strict at the beginning, and that you can live, if we live together in a community, it would also include people that didn't live in a community, in a house, say.
Mm-hmm.
So the people who belong would be, in itself, would provide flexibility.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good start. Took the historic vows, made them relevant to life today in the way of somewhat more open, like simplicity of lifestyle at least sounds different from a vow of poverty. Certainly,
I'll admit that it doesn't sound like what Ness is saying, that you really have to be, be in poverty, or live with poverty. But I couldn't see starting out with that, like Dean said. Perhaps it would be people of the order itself that would take on that.
Mm-hmm.
But also there is also related to the locale they're in. And people have to identify with that too, that if you're trying to convince somebody, they have to relate to you.
Okay. Dean, is that all right?
I think one of the things Mike and I were talking about last night, I don't know if it was you or not, or we were talking about it under the hood here too, is that so many times we think in terms of we have to swallow everything at once, the whole rules, all the vows, all the kind of disciplines at once, and it's like meeting a person and the next day getting married. There's no gradual kind of relationship being built up. There's no progression in mind. There's no rites of passage. And the whole thing of the Catholic novitiate, for instance, does not even enter in. Why don't we use that example in community and say, if there's some core leadership, if there's people who are new to the community and continually coming in as possible new candidates, maybe there needs to be a progression of commitment over a year or two or three or however long the span it needs to be, so that there is always the chance and the opportunity to leave the community when those commitments are no more applicable to that person. Perhaps they reach a point after 6 months where they find out this particular peace focus for me is not where I live, but there is another place where I do live in another community has that focus, I can change, rather than say, well, I committed myself for a year or two, and now I found that I can't, embrace what I initially embraced, but I'll stay anyway because I've committed myself. But there's phases along the way in growth and relationship.
I see also, as you said, that the Trappists and the other orders differ, you can tip sense a different flavor to each abbey, that the one in Minneapolis might not be the same as the one in Seattle, that their focus might be just would encompass the overall order's focus, but might have a local, a little different focus in a locale. I don't know what that means.
Okay, go ahead, Dave.
One of the things that I had thought about is this flexibility is, I think, is a good idea. But I like that. But also, I try to think about Holden in that sense, too, and that there is flexibility here. But one thing that I would like to see would be some sort of consistency to that, too. Some sort of groundwork that's already laid, whether it be in people that are always there, or something like that. That helps to build that sense of community, some sort of consistency, I guess, is what I'm looking for.
How would you build that in? It sounds as though you want temporary vows. Test it for a while in the way of let's try these for a year, or even this rule for a year, and have everything up for grabs at the end of a year, maybe. And you want the possibility of short-term vows, and that was possible in the monastic vows, by the way. We didn't say that in the last couple days. Sister Marie Augusta Neal said the vow of celibacy, for instance, could be the way in which a recent widow or widower, in the midst of now being alone, chooses to be alone instead of feeling stuck with being alone, and exercises in those couple years in that new state of divorced or newly single, or single yet because you have not decided on marriage, for 1 year maximize the availability that that singleness gives you, but don't make a lifelong commitment to that. I think that's within the possibility of orders. But how does the order then get the stability so that some people who choose to move in and out or want the freedom to move in temporarily, something gives a continuity to it. How do you build that in, Marilyn?
Well, there are some examples in the community of Des Arc where they have a concept of three-year novitiates. And they also have a way of being related to the community called Friends of the Arc. So I was thinking of Friends of Martin. where you're free to come and stay with the community, participate in its daily life for a period of days, weeks, or months, and that in conversation with whatever the consensus decision-making portion of the group or how much space is available. Someone could come and experience the community and then could decide, yes, I'd like to stay here for a year of exploration, which mm-hmm. is different than a novitiate.
Mm-hmm.
It's less of a commitment, but it's saying, I will live within the community's daily disciplines, not taking any of the vows, even, but saying, I am making a commitment to live within this for a year, and then at that point they might decide that they want that to count as the first year of a novitiate. And then at the end of 3 years comes a decision point of, okay, am I willing to make a lifetime commitment to this? And that there would be some people who would want to do that, who would want to say, here I stand, here I sit, here I slug it. That for me, I'm kind of confused about whether what the benefits of saying, okay, for 6 years I'll be here,
mm-hmm.
whatever. But something that occurs to me that would be very important for me, and just because I've been raised in a mobile society, would be a concept of Shabbat, Sabbath, and sabbatical. And that maybe every 5 years, each member of the community is encouraged to leave the community for a year, or 2 years, or 3 years if you want to go do a year of work in Africa with the Mennonite Central Committee, and saying, I'm coming back to this community when I'm done, but I need to be refreshed, to get out of our daily, it's starting to feel like a rut to me,
mm-hmm.
or whatever, so that some way you don't always have to bring in new people in order to rejuvenate the community,
mm-hmm.
and you don't have to feel like you're cemented into something, so that it begins to feel like a box instead of a chosen place to live out your freedom.
Mm, that's a good one. Does that help build in flexibility or the first? Yeah, that's. Rick was next and then Mary.
Well, I was just thinking, I made a note on when Mike was talking about it, but it seems like if you take the historical precedent with base principles and you adjust to the local situation, so there are some almost like absolute principles that have passed through the concept of order, but like Mike talked about clothing, well, if you're in a certain part of New York City or someplace, or Seattle or something, you wouldn't want to have just poverty clothing if that didn't fit the situation where you were. So it seemed like it's important to have, I guess, what we're talking about too, is like an evolutionary nature to the community that's starting, and also to the person as they decide whether they become part of the community or not.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't, like Dean said, it's a good example. You don't meet someone next day and say, let's get married.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a good idea, I guess, what Marilyn was talking about.
And one of the ways, one of the reasons that I took the time to do the history is when I did the history, part of the way you adapt them is to find out the original intent of them, because perhaps they have become something that they were never intended to be. And if a better way to make a vow of availability or sharing, there may be a better way of making a vow of sharing, the original intent of that, by some commitment to common usage of the community's possessions, whatever they are, or a simple life, than what became the vow of poverty. So adapting them doesn't necessarily mean watering them down because we're in a new situation, but finding their original intent and trying to stay faithful to that original intent. Sometimes it's more radical to go back and adapt them rather than just adopt them. It's you know, we do the same thing in Lutheranism. You are not really faithful to Martin Luther by necessarily quoting his answers. You're faithful if you ask the questions Luther asked. That, and orthodoxy is often dead orthodoxy, not really the vitality that made something alive. So that's a good one. Mary.
I'm not sure if this connects to what Mike was saying, but we have something similar at Golden. We have staff to stay a minimum of 3 weeks. Only once in 6 years here, we let somebody go home that said after a week, I can't stand this place. I've got to go. And it usually happens, I mean, I'm sure there are exceptions, but usually people that do not like it say, I can't stand this place. The people, the theology, the mountains, whatever it is, after 3 weeks ask to be extended. And if you say to somebody, I'm going to be with you, you say, I promise to be with you for 6 months, and then just decide that isn't for you and leave before it, I just can't imagine anybody. I mean, I think maybe there would be more benefits to say, no, you really promised us, just stick it out and see if some things can change or we can grow or understand what, where you're coming from.
How does that fit in? Oh, okay, it'd be a year of exploration. You're saying if you're going to explore, maybe it's important to have a minimum of time instead of explore by visiting 2 weekends and then deciding. I mean, that's really not a test of the common life of a place. Okay.
The other thing is just to mention what the Church of the Savior does in regard to people in the bishop kind of period. Maybe you talked about this before. They have 3 years of a school of Christian living. Gordon Clausen feels that he can't minister to more than 80 or 90 people. And so that's all the members they have. Not that they limit it, but because of attrition and people dying and moving on, they consistently have 90 people. That turns the city of Washington upside down. But there are 400 or so people who are on the fringes, who come to worship, who do not care to take the 3 year of Christian living courses and have a spiritual counsel and so forth. But once a year, Gordon Clausen gets up in the pulpit and preaches his get out of the pew sermon and go back to your churches where you live. Don't just hang around here. Make a decision, either be committed or go back and do your thing in your own congregation. But you're just taking up space in there and pews. And so after that sermon, there's usually a bunch of people that decide, well, he's right. We've just been hanging around because we like the people or the way he preaches, but we probably are never going to be committed to this people.
And the commitment to membership is 1 year at a time. No one makes a lifelong vow at the Church of the Savior. That, by the way, some of the time during this 3 days should be, if you want to read further, one of the things would be the books concerning the Church of the Savior. Inward Journey, Outward Journey, A Call to Commitment, A New Community, the one Ted talked about, Eighth Day of Creation. Which one would say most about how it's structured? Call to Commitment. Elizabeth O'Connor is the author of all of those. That really is a very, very good example of a Protestant expression faithful to much of the reason for orders and a form of church renewal that has been a very powerful one. They miss, linked with others, they have tried to even send a group out and colonize in another part of D.C., and it didn't work. Now, within the Church of the Savior, there are various worshiping groups, but one entity. It did not work when they tried to have a second community or monastic house or whatever you want to call it. I don't know all the dynamics of that, but there was another hand when I called on Mary. What is, yeah, Mike.
Well, I was just going to say that the link to the others was an important way of providing a continuity or a continuum that you could relate to. If there's a newsletter or a central someplace that put out a newsletter that received letters from the different houses or communities or locations, mm-hmm. and provided that link, continual link.
Does this trigger? So far, it's more. Well, no, it's a combination of things. I'm gonna prime the pump with one, and if that gets you off, is there somebody else that has something right now? When you envisioned a community, part of the order, people committed to one common thing, probably, and that's peacemaking in some way, a reaction against violence, protest movement against the church being silent on that. How did you grant authority? How does the thing function? Who's in charge?
That was the hardest one.
Okay. Two admissions that was the hardest one. Does it mean you worked through it at all, Marilyn?
Well, as part of a reversal, I think that a radical reversal in our culture would be for a community to operate on consensus. That's almost an unknown way of people making decisions in this country. We're so used to majority votes, we're so used to someone being in charge, that I think it would be an incredible process of the people there learning really how to function within consensus. I mean, I don't think you just describe it 5 minutes at the beginning of a community meeting at Holden Village and everybody gets it. That too is a process of learning, but I think it's the most empowering way of making decisions and the way of living together that calls for responsibility, co-responsibility, all sorts of things. So that maybe there would be even some, could be within that some delegation of, okay, we all have consensus that so-and-so for this year will be in charge of getting out the community's newsletter. Not that every task is done by everyone, mm-hmm. but that everyone decides, on major decisions that even those leadership functions are rotated, because the burden, the gift of leadership can get to be a great burden, mm-hmm. and people can learn the gifts of leadership if they're encouraged to do so. And so a rotation of facilitating consensus meetings, things that do, you know, that happen here in terms of our Wednesday night community meetings. But an even deeper commitment to consensus in a transitional community such as this is able to operate.
I think Holly, Pat, and Mike in that order. Okay.
I have had very bad experience with consensus decision making.
Okay, share that.
And I think, not because I think consensus is a bad idea, it's that for me, in order to operate on consensus, the most important thing is the rule. Then that comes with the community, so that you always have something that you can point to that hopefully you have developed by consensus that you can call people to account, because Mennonites are really big on consensus, and Mennonite voluntary service uses that as a model. And my experience of that has been that some people exercise power more than they should, and they manipulate consensus because not everyone feels equal ownership, equal responsibility. And I think it requires a great deal of commitment to do consensus, and you don't always have that, especially if you have a transient community and people who have not made long, long commitments to one another. So for me to do that, I believe in it. I believe it in the abstract because my experience has been so negative. But I think a rule would be really helpful. For me, that's the only way that I can understand getting into a place that works on consensus. consensus is to have a very definite rule that we can all point to and say, are we getting so far afield? Because I sense that sometimes consensus can either be an excuse not to do anything, or it's the same dynamics that people have a problem with in hierarchies continue to operate in consensus unless everyone knows what they're doing. And so I think a rule would be really important.
Thank you. Pat.
I appreciate what Holly said. I wouldn't have said it as articulately. I wanted to speak to the question of consensus and the roles within the community, the question of granting authority, because I think that is one of the most difficult problems. And for me, another way in which the community would be very different from our society would be the image of a circle rather than the image of a ladder, where all of the functions of the community are a part of the community's ownership, and you can know job is more important than any other job. There's no accountability structure in the sense of a hierarchy that you are responsible for making somebody else accountable to a particular task. Rather, there is responsibility that you respond to a task that needs to be done. This means that if there is no job that's more important than any other job, all those jobs are equal. That would be a very hard concept for us to really live with in community. Would be against the idea of a father abbot or a mother abbot. It could also mean, in my experience, this was really helpful, that those functions rotated, that no one person did them for a long period of time. In the third day, we took all the different parts of...
People do not know what the third day is, Pat.
Third day was a plant shop, a traditional small business with all of the requirements of mailing money and ordering plants and overseeing customer relations and all that kind of stuff. And we took all the traditional structure of a small business with a manager and employees, and we made it a non-hierarchical
collective.
And we rotated jobs, and people learned to do other jobs and then moved into them as they had skill and interest, and the group of staff said, yeah, it's time for you either to learn that or it's time to switch, so we'll let Phil do the ordering this week and we'll let Pat do the balancing of the books, I mean, not this week, but this 6-month period. So that it's partly built on what Marilyn is saying, but it's a really important notion, somehow the notion of circle, not hierarchy, and that would be very different from our...
Okay, Mike and then Rick. Yeah, thank you.
I still have trouble with the central authority. I see a need for a representative of the order. If it's a real order, if it's recognized by the church, and if it is, then who talks for it?
Mm-hmm.
If it's who has authority to say over all the rules and speaks for it? Mm-hmm. Not that they have, they are saying this is the rules, but who does the speaking for the order? If we it's like the Jesuits have somebody they are responsible to, a general, but as though the other orders don't have that, but they are accountable to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And who speaks for those people? I don't know how that structure is in Abbey, if there's they have an elder or whatever that speaks for them or is in charge. And I agree that I think that a circle is important to sharing responsibility.
Well, see, if I could just respond for a minute, that's a legitimate function, who speaks for the order. But it seems to me that that's the kind of function which you might do for 6 months or a year, and then which I might do. But that you don't lock a particular person into a particular function for a long period of time. In other words, it's very different from the model of the Church of the Savior with Gordon Cosby at the head of it.
I'm going to get to you, Rick. I think the thing that we're pointing to, we will not solve it, and there will be differences of opinion here. The thing we're pointing to is what I consider to be one of the most important questions, and that's how is the authority granted, or where is the authority? The tendency will be authoritative, and most of the historic orders were authoritative, very clear lines of authority. To simply rebound against that, react against that, and say no authority, not to make a distinction between proper authority and authoritarianism, means that you don't get at your focus or your function, or you spend all of your time being unfocused, and it's so that. But I don't see too many groups working through. To a point where the authority is clear but not authoritative or authoritarianism. It's really hard to do. I get it. If you said, yeah, that was the time, that was the point I had the most trouble imaging it, I understand that. Rick.
Well, I just think that in terms of the community, I find like passage real interesting, but I think to go along with consensus decision making, which would be much more difficult than a traditional way. That's going to require more energy. And the community can't, I would think the community chance for success would be very much decreased if everything we're is trying is new and unfamiliar. So I guess I would see a balance between that. And it's necessary to have to try new things, particularly when we have the energy, if there's the energy to make it, you know, to be successful, but I really would see a balance between that. Also, I would just be curious to direct a question to Pat more on this the place she worked at, how successful that was. I guess, you know, I come out of a business background where specialization has, you know, a productive advantage in terms of competing in that sense. If like, you know, for example, if you have a person every 6 months changes to the outside relations, well, that person has to reestablish. You know, there's an advantage of having the same person working, you know, as the liaison to the external, you know, the world, or as far as bookkeeping or customer relations or whatever. And I've never been. I was in one co-op in the early 70s, which flopped. You know, it had those ideals to some extent, but wasn't very, very well really managed either in the other sense. But I'm just curious to how successful that place you were was.
For a period of time, it was very successful. And we could talk about what made it successful. It had to do with the stability of the staff, the fact that they were the same people for about 5 years. It had to do with the consensus decision-making as a model. It had to do with recognizing that each one of us needed to learn and understand what was involved in keeping the shop a successful shop, so that we had to take ownership of the whole enterprise, not of one specific piece of it. It really was very much a body kind of image. You know, you're an eye, or you're a hand, or you're a foot, or you're an ear. What happened was that all five of us who were involved in that process learned all the different aspects of being a business, and people got used to working with us as a group of people, not only with us as an individual person. There was very little confusion. It was just when we dealt with people externally, because they all knew that we were speaking in that particular entity as a representative of their day. In terms of financially, the shop continued to be a successful small business, making a profit every year, continuing to be, you know, regular business. I mean, we didn't sacrifice the quality or the function, the focus of what we were doing. But we tried to find another way in which people's gifts could be evoked, people's creativity could be encouraged, and the concept of sabbatical, because you really get burned out if you're doing one function for a long period of time. And I think when it changed because people left, and, you know, it evolved into some other kinds of structure. but it still functions pretty much that way with the people who are left. They do take chance.
Let me just interject, and then Ted. Today will be broad sweeps to try to put together a community in an hour and 15 minutes. If there are those of you who really are moving from here and going to form a community or be part of community life sometime in the next 3 weeks, have some time when you can go further with some of these points. So let's don't do that today in kind of questions and go farther on some point, even though you'd like to. Let's keep it broad sweep and see if we can get a few more either specifics or general things. Or is it on this, Ted? Go ahead.
Well, I appreciate what you're saying there, because I've been trained in productivity and efficiency and trying to rebel against that. I mean, too well rebelling. But one way to stand against the world, its values on that, is there's a human price we pay in specialization and a community price we pay too. I think it'd be a good experiment and a good reversal of some dehumanizing values to try that way.
Okay. Is there a essential quality that you would have in your community that isn't up here? Is that a way to ask it and maybe get some more people in on the give and take? Holly.
Humor.
Can you build? You just build that in, or you?
If I'm in your community, it's built in.
All right. Well, the community just divided on that one, man. Yeah. Yes, Marilyn.
John Rivers.
Marilyn.
On the issue of focus, I have been agonizing over this thing for a long time, and I think I'm almost ready to try and aim some words at it. But in terms of a focus on addressing the violence of our society,
okay,
for me, that is an essential link between peacemaking and poverty. And there's a couple ways I can describe this, and Max points at this. And I think the historical reality that people of order in orders took a vow of poverty and tended to live with the poor of their culture, with the marginalized, tended to even wear the dress of that contemporary time, at least originally. They dressed as the poor people of their time. I mean, that got to be silly, wearing the robes they wear now, completely out of the context of who the poor are now. I mean, that doesn't carry over. Metz says something on page 49 that was helpful for me in starting to put a finger on this, because my intuition has been telling me for years that we need to live with poor people. And he says, the reason is that a church community engaged in following Jesus has to put up with being despised by the wise and the powerful. But what it cannot afford to do for the sake of this following of Christ is to become despised by the poor and the small, by those who do not have anyone to help. For it is these who are the privileged ones as far as Jesus is concerned, and they must also be the privileged ones in this church. Now, as that clicks with me, and as I have talked with almost all of my best friends come from middle and upper class, and everyone from those classes that I've ever talked to who has lived with poor people says they're not good at it. And that includes myself.
Mm-hmm.
And as I struggle with that, I think, okay, in a country that we don't have a large section of poor people, who's going to end up serving Jesus? As he talks about the incarnation that keeps going on, the hungry and the thirsty and all that. Seems historically that was a real emphasis of the order, and it was a real offense to the wise and the powerful that these spiritual people were aligning themselves or living with the poor, whether it was Francis or Mother Teresa or whomever it is. That keeps freaking us out. People actually go do that. I don't think we have to be good at living with the poor to live with them, because I think almost inherent in that, for me, has been that I have to be able to communicate with them. That I have to be able to teach them something, give them something. And if I'm not one of them, I won't be able to, good at doing that. But I think what Metz is saying and what I have experienced is that that is not the issue. It's that the poor are my teachers. That they will say things to me that I will hear nowhere else. And that if we don't live with the poor, I'm going to be out of touch with a reality. We've been talking about women's reality, men's reality. I think there is a reality of poverty. That I don't know that I can make peace holistically in the world without being in touch with that reality. Now, that doesn't mean it would have to be the major focus. Could still be education of the middle and upper middle class. But I don't know that I can be as effective a peacemaker unless I know the people who are not shalom in this system. They will teach me dynamics of that I will learn experientially from them, and I'll hate it in some sense. So for me, that would be a real mark of an order, and that's something that I don't know, it's a paradox, attracted to and repelled by at the same time. And whether that was something as simple as a Christ room in this community, in every house of the Order of St. Martin, where street people, I mean, the people that we most think we probably have the least in common with, if that makes any sense, where, as Met says, those who have no one to help them, that even if we made a minimal commitment to one person at a time, or one person longer term, I just think that we need to have one of those teachers in our household or in our order.
I see a lot of nodding. Is there verbal reaction, or is there a... Mary?
Yeah, that's helpful for me to say a Christ room or something, because I'm one of those people who tried living with the poor for 8 years and didn't do a good job at it. And finally, especially the blacks in our neighborhood, in essence, said, honky, you go out in the suburbs and tell your white friends, they're the problem, we need to live in here. And that's kind of what I got the feeling that maybe I was just rationalizing that I was so poor living with the poor. But I wonder if our ministry isn't also, I mean, I think we need teachers, and I don't know if you live there, being taught by them, and then go out in the suburbs for your real ministry, but you live among them, because my idea of trying to save Washington, D.C., when the ministry was soon dispelled very quickly, bringing Jesus to the masses, Jesus was there long before he had come. And so all of the things that we developed through civic associations and feeding programs and housing programs that I felt so good about, in essence, we were told, I think, several times, just like that, you go out and tell your white friends they're the problem. And that's where the ministry is. So.
Yeah, I guess I'm trying to say that it's not
connected
to the
Christ
room, but it is to you learned that from those poor people. I mean, would you have learned that if you had been living in the suburbs? I mean, you may not have felt
we
like you...
We had to move from the suburbs into the city to realize that we should have probably stayed in the suburbs and done our thing there. I mean, I'm just... Maybe that's...
Mike?
Yeah, I don't... I guess I didn't go somewhere too. I've never had to live and with the poor, and I don't know if I moved to Minneapolis and joined a house where we lived next door to poor people, you know, lived in a neighborhood, and if it was really radically poor, would it provide too much conflict with the focus of the peace issue? With living among blacks and having your place broken into, or in a depressed area where, I don't know what happens. I mm-hmm. worked in a bad area where you know, you had to lock everything up every night, and the area I worked in, if you walk down the street, you could very well get mugged, or just a brick thrown out at you, a passing car, and shot. so you didn't walk out at night. And so those are the kinds of things I think about when I live in a depressed area like that. That you could get yourself murdered just walking down the street. And do you want to live with that? I mean, if you do want, then you should be relating to the poor, and that should be a day all consuming type thing to me. I'm sure that's better.
Okay, a couple things. First of all, you could question the link between peacemaking and poverty. Okay, I mean, that could be the debate. The reversal of value, another thing that's going on is in the reversal of values, we will tend to have the least inconvenient reversal of values we can find. Will we not? I mean, if the things that were up on the board so far attracted you or didn't attract you, you saw a meeting at which you decided this. Now you see a neighborhood in which you either want to live or don't live. It's a different thing in the way of whether or not you feel invited in or repelled by it when you get to what neighborhood are we going to live in. So that, okay, spent.
Along the lines of that, that's where I begin to see a real link between the vow of poverty and the vow of celibacy in the best sense of the word celibacy, of availability. Mm-hmm. Because I think oftentimes what keeps me from going into a neighborhood and living is a lot of my possessions, a lot of which I associate with either family or living with other people or some aspect that makes me not available. I can contemplate being available and giving up my possessions if I'm not going to be married, if I'm not going to have a family, if I'm not going to do a lot of things, that then I have to have some broader sense of what I own. And yeah, Mary.
Well, and what you said the other night, that peacemaking is not the concern of the poor. I mean, I think there is going to be a...
You mean the peace war issue?
Yeah. Peace war issues, not reconciliation and liberation things. But peace war issues is not what the poor and oppressed people are into.
I wanted to add another thing for me as far as a Marx, and it depends. I don't see it up there, so I don't know if it necessarily has to be one, but the issue of inclusiveness in a community, whether that is desirable or not.
Yes.
I mean, many of the orders are all men or all women or all white or all whatever. But if the inclusiveness is a mark, then I think another mark has to be dealing with conflict and anger some way, because that will happen. And you have a choice of dealing with it or avoiding it in a community.
Pat.
I just like to speak to that because this is a very much an idealism in my mind, the inclusiveness, but it seems to me another one of the barriers is the isolation that we get into as members of different either ethnic groups or economic groups or sexual groups, and that inclusiveness means not only physical inclusiveness, but some kind of way of overcoming that isolation so that we are in communion with, communication with, dialogue with people who are very different than we are as an integral part of the community.
Mm-hmm.
And does that mean not communism? Yes.
Does that mean what?
Not
tokenism. Oh, okay.
Because it's breaking down the barriers that you like talking to Mike.
Rick was... If I've missed your hand, raise it again. Rick's is the only one I've seen in the last couple of minutes.
To me, this kind of gets right into the concept of worship. We want to bring worship in.
Okay. It isn't up there yet. All right.
Yeah, I spent some time thinking about worship.
All right.
Worship? What's strange? So it seems to me it's like, I guess my thought was, worship would be that we need prayer, and to have a prayer broken down, religious prayer maybe is to put that in, but prayer in two senses, a private prayer and a corporate prayer, and that would be some time for silence, kind of contemplative silence. And like, I was really touched yesterday by the comments of Elizabeth O'Connor about afraid to be quiet or alone, just to deal with one's loneliness that we all have to face. I think the DV would be conducive to dealing with our differences and helping out inclusiveness. And then have some form of worship where here I've got this combination of right brain, left brain, like I think of recently, like the chanting we did a couple of days ago. But a worship that would, the community would determine that, but a worship that would bring the spirit alive for us. I think a lot of us have shared sometimes vespers. The intent is good here, but a lot of times the spirit does not speak to us here through vespers. And to go to scripture, where Christ talks about the words of God in spirit and truth, we tend to hear, and a lot of ways I think we worship God in truth a lot, but not a lot in spirit. The kingdom of God is within us. How do we set a structure? I was really moved by when you talked about you're a leader of the church and yet you struggle with your prayer life. And you have not had a structure, so we have to pray as a group, whether it's quiet, contemplative prayer. So some mode, some form to build that in, because I think it's a real weakness of this, at least for myself too. And not, so I need a structure for prayer. So there would be that. And then another aspect would be, see, all that would be the vertical. Then the horizontal, which I was again moved by Elizabeth O'Connor, was the dialogue. Even have a structure for personal support groups where we can get past the superficialness and dating and have a regular encounter for one another in dealing with our differences, whether it's straight and gays, or men and women, or young and old, or rich and poor, and then have, if necessary, have skills, have a communication skill set up. Yesterday or day before yesterday, I heard you say, how many people are hearing? A lot of people are talking. How many people really hear? How much time do we really spend structuring and developing our communication skills so we really understand what the other person is saying? To me, that would be really important in terms of dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Pat.
Just for me, another part of the common life is eating together.
Okay.
Really important. And by eating together, I also mean fasting together, or some of the bodily ways in which we share.
Okay. Would you, again, in your mind, would you have that as a kind of vow or an assumption as part of the rule that there would be the expectation of some common meals, like at least one a week or some such thing? And would there be a vow of fasting, or would it be optional? Or do you, you're shaking your head. They would be part of a common agreement. They would be part of disciplines. Let me get back to flexibility. Do you see that if we went along for 1 year and a new person came, how many things are going to be up for grabs a year from now, and how soon is it going to be? Look, if either come into it or don't join, but don't try to change it. I mean, we're living. Do you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can I
just, I don't know whether this speaks to it, but it seems to me that part of what's in my mind is a rhythm of life.
Okay. Sounds Benedictine. Okay.
Which people who have agreed to be part of the community, whether that's taking vows or whatever, do, because they have chosen it to do that. Those who want to come as part of the bishop or friends of Martin, try that on.
Okay.
They're not obligated to do that until they choose to move into that. But if you choose to move into that, then that becomes part of the rhythm that is not only an individual personal rhythm, but becomes a corporate rhythm.
Okay. Would you build in, I'm just going back and testing some, whether or not we're just, we get at the end and there's no way to construct this animal. Would you build in at the end of a year or two that everything is in fact up for grabs for the whole group and you'd have to reshape it? Would that be a good point of, Thomas Jefferson said that the Constitution of the United States, I think, was up for grabs every 3 years or something.
20 years.
Okay.
20 years.
There should be revolution every generation.
Okay. Would you build that in? Or is that too chaotic, and you could just imagine 3 years, 10 years down the pike, having this all up for grabs will destroy the stability or the... I'm not asking for an answer at this point. I'm just... there were three or four other hands. David? Okay.
Well, I was going to say, it looks like what we're getting at, too, is not only that rhythm, but also is some of that, what we speak of wholeness, too. And I would just put some form of community exercise or something like that, where, you know, okay, you look towards the wholeness of we're eating and fasting and worship and dialogue, and I would say some form of exercise.
So, with your own why. Like right brain, left brain, you'd also have... mental and physical.
Okay.
Thank you. Mary?
For me, one of the main things would be I need a group of people to help me carry out the vision of me. And I think, I don't know whether it be a vow or a vow, but if you promise to help other people discover who they are and what they're called to be, that you invoke the gifts and you help those people use those gifts in ministry. That to me is one of the biggest reasons for having a group of people that I struggle to deal with.
Okay. Spence.
Just following what Mary said and some of the things you said, I can envision one possibility being having the rule be something that isn't up for grabs every year.
Uh-huh.
And the rule be very simple, like our rule is invoking gifts and keeping the vision. And the rest of the things follow. Be up for grabs every year, but in the context of that rule that doesn't change, having a very simple rule
uh-huh.
rather than a 4-page constitution that either doesn't change or is totally up for grabs.
Uh-huh. After this process, and we're almost at the end of the time, after even this much of an exercise, I hope that you will be able to hear with a lot more appreciation and sense of discretion or discernment, whatever you want to call it, when healthy communities are described. For instance, Lonzo DeVosto, Society of the Ark, I remember a discussion that he had about the essential qualities of a faithful community. First was a shared faith, and many of the things that are up here in the way of a standard to bat up against, or the only way the consensus works, is that you have something to make reference off of that was agreed upon. You do not have community unless there's a point of commonness. And for him, that was the Christian faith or shared faith. Now, you can ask further questions after that, but he started with that. Second one, I've never heard anybody else say, although you brought it in down here, a way to dramatize that regularly, act it out, symbolize it, visualize it, dance it, or so it was not just worship once a week. The liturgy was for him a way you kept that story alive within the community in lots of ways. And the last one was a vocation, a ministry outside of the community. The community existed in order to, so that it was the consensus not only had something to bat up against, but the given was that there was a mission outside of yourself, so that it was not self-preservation questions that were being asked. It was the focus question was high on the agenda. When I heard those three, that to me, those are good guidelines toward healthy community. I've saved things for years that have something to do with orders. This is Monica Furlong, The Shape of a Contemporary Asceticism. I'm just going to share a couple things and then we'll end it for the day. The question is, what are the conditions I need for spiritual growth? There was something at least partly conscious about the suffering. It was self-inflicted of those early monks. We and our contemporaries, less clear-headed, often find we have acted self-punishingly without the slightest awareness of what we did. This is not to say that we should all suddenly take hair shirts and chains, but rather keep a kind of openness and reverence toward the insights of the past, never quite knowing that a day may not come in which fasting or other ancient practices may not become deeply relevant to us. In the meantime, it would be difficult for most of us to turn to such practices without a self-consciousness and or a romanticism. So she's going to say, be very careful if you move into some kind of forms of spirituality. And then I think she has a very helpful comment. If that self-consciousness or romanticism supplies a secret reward of its own, it will make the whole enterprise meaningless. Until we can use a spiritual method without secret self-congratulation, it is probably too much for us. Wouldn't that be a nice thing to have in your background when you go in to establishing for ourselves our spiritual disciplines or our vows? Until we can use a spiritual method without secret self-congratulation, it is probably too much for us. So you start with those that do not have that, you know, ooh, that I would be congratulating myself that I fasted all day. Then that's probably not a good place. Those are the clues I think you have to look for if you're going to sit down and do this task. Let me do two things. Share a little bit from the book on orders that I got most of the research on the historic orders from, and this is the way he ends his introduction. If we look squarely at the 20th century, which refuses to learn from the experience of two world wars, we can hardly do otherwise than call it a century of destruction. Hurtling from one catastrophe into another, our world seems unable to find a way out of this vortex of death. The hideous symbol of this century is the man armed with a machine gun, stumping off over endless heaps of ruins, and every Christian who really takes faith seriously is weighed down by the question, what solution is there to demonic apocalypse? Who is capable of offering effective challenge to the beast from the abyss? Who has the inner strength to meet the robot of our times and to defeat that robot in spiritual combat? These are the tremendous questions that will run like a basic theme through Christian history in the coming decades. To expect solution from statesmen is vain. They cannot give what they do not possess. Governments think too exclusively in terms of politics and military strategy, to the total neglect of the spirit. That is why they are now so completely barren of new ideas and have to depend solely on diplomacy, which has constantly proved inadequate. Any attempt to achieve renewal, to arrive at a Christianity free from compromise, must necessarily involve a return to the founders of religious orders. Indeed, a renewal of the orders in their original intent would be one of the most effective aids in the spiritual conflict of our times. A major possibility is the deliberate endeavor to create new orders. Even though it seems a fantastic undertaking, perhaps, until we consider that at a time when the face of monasticism is so radically changing, it need be no utopia. Indeed, the idea is really the purpose of the present work, this book. The reader must therefore bear with the author if he sometimes presents in faltering tones thoughts which he would rather have lent the accent of adjuration. I don't know exactly what he means by that. Threatened Christendom needs new orders because only a new brotherhood or sisterhood of those marked by pain, as Albert Schweitzer put it, can provide the antidote to the spiritual malady of our day. Deliverance from the distress of our times can come only from small groups with the courage to remain small. Their community must be based on monastic rules that include binding vows and recognize the principle of religious sacrifice. And they can flourish only in silence. I'm jumping some. It isn't a consistent paragraph, but I've picked some things. The new monasticism can bring about a real transformation in contemporary attitudes only if it does not remain entrenched behind a wall of traditional thinking. Instead of acting simply as the custodian of the past, it must deliberately turn toward the future. The new foundations must blaze new trails and not be satisfied with being mere replicas of earlier orders. Throughout monastic history, such daring ventures have been undertaken. For all that they are rooted in eternity, the new orders must wear the colors of the 20th century, just as the eremitic movement was cast in the 4th century mold. However much we may long for new orders, they cannot be artificially created if they are not to be a sham. What is holy can never be commanded. It always grows like a living organism and almost in silence. Last quote, new orders can only be prayed for. I'd like to do two things, three things. That is, offer you, if you wanted to know what happened after the letter we gave you yesterday on the Order of St. Martin, David Anderson was asked by Sojourners to write a description of the Order of St. Martin as it appeared to David Anderson in 1976. This is a reprint, if you want a copy of that. If you tried to form an order, you can see what we did in Pittsburgh in the way of forming an order. The other is, if you do want a continuation of a discussion more on forming a community, I would suggest that before you go into a community, you do some study, including The Psychology of Community by Dr. Robert McAllister, who describes communities that just don't make it. The mothering kind, the kind that have no boundaries, the kind that have a charismatic leader, and so you know they're from there if they start using certain buzzwords that everyone who comes from there uses, because the cultic hero uses those. You'll find some helpful things in here. The third thing, last thing, is that if in putting together these last 3 weeks there is further interest in pursuing some of this, or groups of people who really do want to consider living in community when they leave Holden, just bring that to either a planning committee or Janet or Spence or myself, and we'll arrange for the space for that, and not have the kind of time parameters of the 9 o'clock session. So, thank you. Yes, Ted.
One more book. I read is really good. It's called Community of Faith: Models and Strategies for Developing Christian Communities. Stuff on clarifying the meaning of community and fostering Christian dreams. A lot of sociological dynamics.
Who's the author?
Evelyn and James Wyatt.
Library book?
Library. In the bookstore too. The more I read, I recommend. But again, I've one more book that's been in my room for a while.
Thank you all very much.